From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I think that, you know, there are responsibilities that all nations have, even in war. And if it appears that our conduct in some way supported violations of the laws of war, then I think that we have to know about that.
President Obama says he'll consider investigating the bloodiest slaughter of the war in Afghanistan, the massacre of hundreds, perhaps thousands, of suspected Taliban prisoners of war in late 2001. Until now, the U.S. has blocked the investigation. The man in charge was CIA-backed General Abdulrashid Dostum, who, with his Afghan forces, worked closely with U.S. special forces and allegedly killed some 2,000 people and buried them in mass graves. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has recently reappointed Dostum as the military chief of staff. We'll be joined by Susanna Serkin, the deputy director of Physicians for Human Rights, the group that uncovered the mass graves in 2002, and New York Times reporter James Risen. And a new report by a team of federal inspectors general reveals the Bush administration's surveillance operations collected information well beyond the warrantless wiretapping program. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Attorney General Eric Holder is considering whether to appoint a criminal prosecutor to investigate the Bush administration's interrogation practices involving the CIA. Newsweek reports Holder has become increasingly troubled after reviewing the Bush administration's interrogation policies. He reportedly told one associate that what he saw in the reports about the treatment of prisoners at the CIA's black sites, quote, turned my stomach. Holder is expected to make a decision in the coming weeks and has already discussed several potential candidates to serve as special prosecutor. Holder is considering the probe despite opposition from President Obama, who resisted an effort by congressional Democrats to establish a truth commission. Obama has said the nation should be looking forward and not backwards. Holder told Newsweek, quote, I hope that whatever decision I make would not have a negative impact on the president's agenda, but that can't be a part of my decision, he said. The CIA is also coming under increasing criticism for failing to inform Congress about a highly classified targeted assassination program started by the CIA after September 11th. According to the Wall Street Journal, the program focused on the CIA's attempt to capture or assassinate terrorists. The journal reports the CIA spent money on planning and possibly some training. It was acting on a 2001 presidential legal pronouncement known as a finding, which authorized the CIA to pursue such efforts, even though the Ford administration had banned assassinations in the 1970s. Congress only learned about the program last month when President Obama's CIA Director Leon Panetta ended the initiative last month. Senator Dianne Feinstein appeared on Fox News Sunday. She didn't describe the program, but confirmed reports that Vice President Dick Cheney had ordered the CIA to withhold information about the program from Congress.
The answer is yes, Congress should have been told. We should have been briefed before the commencement of this kind of sensitive program. Director Panetta did brief us 2 weeks ago, I believe it was on the 24th of June, said he had just learned about the program, described it to us, indicated that he had canceled it, and as had been reported, did tell us that he was told that the vice president had ordered that the program not be briefed to the Congress.
This does not mark the first time the Bush administration has been accused of carrying out targeted assassinations. Earlier this year, investigative journalist Seymour Hersh said publicly the Bush administration ran an executive assassination ring that reported directly to Vice President Dick Cheney.
Congress has no oversight of it. It's an executive assassination wing, essentially, and it's been going on and on and on. And just today in the Times, there was a story saying that its leader, a three-star admiral named McRaven, ordered to stop to certain activities because there were so many collateral deaths. It's been going under President Bush's authority. They've been going into countries, not talking to the ambassador or to the CIA station chief, and finding people on a list and executing them and leaving.
According to Hersh, the program was carried out by the Joint Special Operations Commander, JSOC. The former head of JSOC, Stanley McChrystal, is now Obama's top commander in Afghanistan. In other intelligence news, a government report released Friday found the Bush administration's post-September 11th surveillance efforts went well beyond the widely publicized warrantless wiretapping program. The report called the surveillance program unprecedented and questioned its legal justification. The report also raised questions about the effectiveness of the surveillance operation. Some CIA officials complained that much of the data from the program was, quote, vague and out of context, so they turned to other information sources. The report was compiled at the request of Congress by five government agency watchdogs: the Inspectors General of the Justice Department, Pentagon, CIA, Directorate of National Intelligence, and National Security Agency. More than 200 top officials and frontline agents in defense and intelligence agencies were interviewed for the report, but several top Bush administration officials refused to speak, including former Attorney General John Ashcroft, former Justice Department Attorney John Yoo, former CIA Director George Tenet, and David Addington, former top aide to Vice President Cheney. President Obama has returned from his first official trip to sub-Saharan Africa. In a speech before Ghana's parliament, Obama urged Africans across the continent to take greater responsibility for stamping out war, corruption, and disease plaguing the region.
Must start from the simple premise that Africa's future is up to Africans. I say this knowing full well the tragic past that has sometimes haunted this part of the world. After all, I have the blood of Africa within me.
President Obama went on to speak about his family's ties to Africa, about his father being born in Kenya, and about how his grandfather was briefly imprisoned during Kenya's struggle for liberation against Britain. During the speech, Obama offered, quote, technical assistance and logistical support to help Africa fight against terrorists and war criminals. He also defended the growing role of AFRICOM, the U.S. military command in Africa.
And let me be clear. Our Africa command is focused not on establishing a foothold on the continent, but on confronting these common challenges to advance the security of America, Africa, and the world.
While in Ghana, the president and his family toured Cape Coast Castle, a seaside fortress used by slave traders starting in the 17th century. The former slave dungeon is now a monument to millions of Africans cast into slavery.
I think as Americans, and as African Americans, obviously, there's a special sense that, on the one hand, this place was a place of profound sadness. On the other hand, it is here where the journey of much of the African-American experience began.
Economic analysts are predicting Goldman Sachs has earned a staggering $2 billion since March. The bank's stock value has soared 68% this year, and analysts predict the bank will pay a total of $18 billion in compensation and benefits this year. That's an average of more than $600,000 per employee. Goldman Sachs has been a major beneficiary of the government's bank bailout program. Last year, the Bush administration quietly funneled $13 billion to Goldman Sachs as part of the bailout of the failed insurance giant AIG. The government also gave Goldman Sachs $28 billion in low-interest loans. While Goldman Sachs is making billions, the state of public higher education in California is in a state of crisis. University of California Board of Regents is preparing to meet this week to discuss plans to implement widespread budget cuts after the state cut about 20% of its support for the university system, amounting to $813 million deficit. On Friday, University of California President Mark Udoff proposed system-wide employee furloughs for most faculty and staff. Under the plan, workers would be forced to take as many as 26 unpaid days off, or the equivalent of a 10% salary reduction. Udoff has also proposed deferred hiring and cuts in academic programs. University of California Davis has already shut down its liver transplant program, and UC Santa Cruz has axed some science and music classes. In more fallout from the economic crisis, two privately owned zoos in Massachusetts may soon be forced to close and euthanize some of its animals. The Boston Globe reports that unless the state restores $4 million in funding, the Franklin Park Zoo and the Stone Zoo will soon run out of money. If the zoos are closed, new homes will be needed for more than 1,000 animals, But zoo officials are warning that some 200 animals would not find homes and would be euthanized. On Capitol Hill, the Senate confirmation hearing for Supreme Court Justice nominee Sonia Sotomayor begins today. If confirmed, Sotomayor will become the nation's first Latina justice and only third female justice. Here in New York, the Bronx neighborhood where she grew up is celebrating that one of their own could soon have a lifetime seat on the nation's highest court. This is Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr.
We know collectively in the city of New York that she is a person that has never forgotten her heritage, her culture, where she comes from. It makes me happy that whenever she gives speeches outside of New York, that she always talks about where she's from the Bronx, from the projects in Bronxdale, that she's a New Yorican.
Monsignor James White of the Blessed Sacrament Church in the Bronx also prays Sotomayor.
But for the students, just knowing that there's hope that they can be whatever they want to be if they put the work into it. And as I said, evidently she worked very hard and just gave a lot of hope and a future to the community, especially to the Bronx, because sometimes people think of the Bronx as other than what it is. But it gave them a lot of hope.
One of Iran's most senior clerics issued an unusual decree on Saturday, calling the country's rulers usurpers and transgressors for their treatment of opposition protesters in recent weeks. The New York Times reports Grand Ayatollah Hossein Ali Montazeri's decree marked the strongest condemnation by a religious figure since the contested presidential election a month ago. The 87-year-old Montazeri was a leader of the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, as was once designated the successor to Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. In Iraq, five Christian churches were bombed on Sunday, killing at least four people. Meanwhile, a roadside bomb hit a convoy carrying U.S. Ambassador Christopher Hill. The bomb barely missed Hill's vehicle and caused minor damage to another one. The bombing is believed to be the first direct attack on a U.S. ambassador since the war began in Iraq in 2003. In Afghanistan, four Marines died Sunday in two separate roadside bomb blasts. On Friday, eight British troops died. Overall, 192 foreign troops have been killed so far this year in Afghanistan, a 40% jump from the same period last year. More British troops have now died in Afghanistan than in Iraq. Meanwhile, President Obama's ordered national security officials to look into allegations that the Bush administration resisted efforts to investigate a CIA-backed Afghan warlord over the killings of at least 2,000 Taliban prisoners in 2001. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. Exiled Uyghur leader Rabia Khadr appeared on Capitol Hill Friday with lawmakers who introduced a resolution to condemn China's repression of Uyghur protests in western China. Democratic Congress member Bill Delahunt of Massachusetts called on China to end the violence against the Uyghurs.
We urge all of our colleagues to join myself and Congressman Rohrabacher in supporting this resolution that condemns the violent crackdown on peaceful Uyghur protests and calls upon the Chinese government to stop its irresponsible slander. Rabia Khadr.
Rabia Khadr, who runs the World Uyghur Congress, accused the Chinese government of cracking down violently on protesters in the Xinjiang region of China.
Look at them.
Just like Chinese government's brutal killing and murder of the pro-democracy students in 1989 at Tiananmen Square, the same thing that took place last Sunday. The Chinese authorities brutally killed and wounded hundreds of people.
And in Honduras, the military-backed government has lifted a curfew imposed following the coup that ousted President Manuel Zelaya. Meanwhile, two members of the opposition political party Unificación Democrática have been assassinated. Also over the weekend, Honduran police detained six employees of the regional television network Telesur and Venezuela state-run station Venezolana de Televisión. The journalists were taken to police headquarters for 5 hours, and their passports were confiscated. Larry Sanchez of Telesur said, quote, "They told us we should leave the country because our security wasn't guaranteed and we were riskier. We have intelligence and we're following you," he said. Honduran soldiers also arrested Telesur journalists at gunpoint in their hotel rooms on June 29th and later let them go. Telesur is a regional television network funded in part by the Venezuelan government. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 800 stations, on Pacifica and NPR stations, as well as on low-power FM and college and community radio stations. We also are broadcasting on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks. On Dish Network, channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, channel 375. And where video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take, as over 200 are. Well, today we begin with our top story. 7.5 years after the massacre of at least 2,000 suspected Taliban prisoners of war during the Bush administration-led invasion of Afghanistan, the incident and its apparent cover-up might finally be the subject of an investigation. Over the weekend, President Obama said, quote, there are responsibilities that all nations have, even in war. And he told CNN's Anderson Cooper that he was not opposed to investigating the Dashti Leili massacre of November 2001.
It now seems clear that the Bush administration resisted efforts to pursue investigations of an Afghan warlord named General Dostum, who was on the CIA payroll. It's now come out there were hundreds of Taliban prisoners under his care who got killed. Right. Some were suffocated in a steel container. Others were shot, possibly buried in mass graves. Would you support, would you call for an investigation into possible war crimes in Afghanistan?
Yeah, the indications that this had not been properly investigated just recently was brought to my attention. So what I've asked my national security team to do is to collect the facts for me that are known. And we'll probably make a decision in terms of how to approach it once we have all the facts gathered up.
But you wouldn't resist categorically an investigation?
I think that, you know, there are responsibilities that all nations have, even in war. And if it appears that our conduct in some way supported violations of the laws of war, then I think that we have to know about that.
President Obama's comments follow initial statements from other officials in his administration Friday, who said the Pentagon and the FBI had no jurisdiction over the mass killing by a U.S.-backed warlord, General Abdulrashid Dostum. A Pentagon spokesman told the Associated Press, quote, there is no indication that U.S. military forces were there or involved or had any knowledge of this, so there was not a full investigation conducted because there was no evidence that there was anything from a DOD perspective to investigate. The infamous Dashti Leili massacre is back in the news in the wake of new evidence published in a New York Times report last Friday and Saturday that shows the Bush administration blocked at least three federal investigations into the alleged war crimes. The article is by journalist James Risen. He notes that, quote, American officials had been reluctant to pursue an investigation because the warlord, General Abdulrashid Dostum, was on the payroll of the CIA and his militia worked closely with United States Special Forces in 2001. Well, Dostum served as a defense official in the Karzai government. Last year, he was suspended for threatening a rival at gunpoint and lived in Turkey in exile. But ahead of these August 20th elections that are coming up, Karzai has invited Dostum back to the country and reinstated him as military chief of staff. This is a warning from General Dostum back in late 2001 when he was the U.S.-backed commander of Northern Alliance forces and traveling around the country to get remaining Taliban to surrender. This excerpt is from the award-winning documentary from Jamie Duran's Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death, that had its premiere on Democracy Now! 6 years ago.
If you upset me, I'm telling you, No one except God up there and me down here will care about you. You will lose your honor. This is very serious.
General Dostin.
Your village might be looted. Your family will be in danger. They'll be killed. They'll be raped. There will be no safety for them. I'm telling you straight. You must be honest with me. I'm being honest with you here.
Filmmaker Jamie Duran also interviewed then-Pentagon advisor Richard Perle about the administration's decision to ally with a warlord like Dostum.
You have to balance out competing interests. Obviously, we would much rather be aligned with Mother Teresa. That wasn't possible in those circumstances. It does lead to a responsibility on our part for trying to help reshape Afghanistan along more humane and democratic lines. And I think that's exactly what we should be doing.
I'm joined right now by two guests. Susanna Serkin is in the studio with us here in the firehouse, the Deputy Director of Physicians for Human Rights, the group that discovered the mass graves in 2002, and that's been calling for a full investigation for years. And we're joined from Washington, D.C., by the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter James Risen. His latest article on how the Bush administration impeded investigations into the massacre and the mass graves is called U.S. in Action Seen After Taliban POWs Died. Risen is also the author of the 2006 book, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! James Risen, let's begin with you. This piece that appeared first online on the Times on Friday and in the paper on Saturday. What is the latest that you have found?
Well, basically, what I tried to look at was, I tried not to get caught up in something that I think in the past has slowed down some of the efforts by journalists to look into this. I think in the past, one of the mistakes some journalists made was to try and prove a direct involvement by the U.S. personnel in the massacre itself. I frankly don't believe that any U.S. military personnel were involved in the massacre. And, you know, U.S. Special Forces troops who were traveling with Dostum have long maintained that they knew nothing about this. And, you know, so I tried not to go down that road. What I wanted to find out was what happened after the massacre in Washington and look at the role of senior U.S. policymakers as the reports came in of this massacre. What did they do or not do about the responsibility of the United States to look into what had happened and what a U.S.-backed warlord had done. So I tried to look at it from a Washington perspective, which in the past had not really been done by other journalists. And so that's what I found, was that whether or not U.S. personnel were involved or had foreknowledge, you know, knowledge ahead of time or knowledge contemporaneously with the massacre, what I did find was, after the fact, a series of reports came in from different organizations to the Bush administration, basically warning them, you have to look into this in one way or the other, that the evidence was overwhelming that something had happened and that it was the responsibility of the Bush administration to look into this, or at least to push for an international investigation, because Dostum had been on the CIA payroll, was part of a U.S.-backed alliance that was taking over Afghanistan. And what I found was, time after time, in different agencies and as far and in the White House, Bush administration officials repeatedly ignored evidence or just decided or discouraged efforts to open investigations into the massacre.
You talk about the three different times and the different U.S. Agencies, the FBI, the Pentagon, the State Department. How did each block the investigation?
Well, what happened very quickly after the after the incident, this and anybody who's been to Afghanistan knows that nothing stays secret there for very long. And the word of this massacre, mass killing, the you know, the suffocation deaths of so many prisoners of war, began, the word of that began to circulate in northern Afghanistan very quickly. And what the first warning that I think any senior officials began to hear from was the International Committee for the Red Cross warned a senior coalition military commander very quickly that this is the responsibility of the U.S.-led coalition to look into, and you have a responsibility to do that. That military commander gave no response whatsoever to the ICRC official who told him about it. Soon after that, the prisoners, some of the survivors of the mass killing, were taken to Guantanamo in very soon after the massacre. Probably got there, they were among the first prisoners, I believe, taken to Guantanamo after the prison there opened in January 2002. FBI officials who were at Guantanamo in 2002 began to interrogate prisoners there, and many of them, as many as 10, I was told, told the FBI that they had survived this mass killing, and they provided very consistent descriptions of the incident. And a senior FBI official who was at Guantanamo told me that he passed on the reports from these interrogations to FBI headquarters and urged an investigation, and was told not to, to drop the matter because it was not part of the FBI's mission at Guantanamo. Separately, the State Department eventually, Secretary Powell, Colin Powell, asked the war crimes ambassador to Pierre Prosper to begin to investigate. He tried to investigate this, went to Afghanistan and interviewed General Dostum, the warlord, and was then very quickly found that the Afghan government under Hamid Karzai had no interest in investigating this. He also found, by the way, that the international community, the UN in particular, was very reluctant to investigate this. And then when he came back to Washington, he found that there was the similar reluctance at the White House. And he talked to Zalmay Khalilzad, who was then the White House coordinator for Afghanistan, who raised concerns about whether it would be good to investigate something like this, particularly when the Karzai government was not interested in doing it. And then I found at the Pentagon asked the Special Forces teams in an informal inquiry whether they had any knowledge of this, and they said no. And but then a series of meetings happened between Physicians for Human Rights and Pentagon officials in 2002, in which the Physicians for Human Rights, which had found this mass grave, Dashti Laili, I think in January 2002, were repeatedly told that there was no reason for the Pentagon to investigate. By the summer, or late summer of 2002, I think after Newsweek broke a very important story on this, and a cover story in August, that got some renewed attention. But the Pentagon continued to deny requests from Physicians for Human Rights to provide security at the, to go back to the grave site and do a full examination of the mass grave that they had found. And also efforts by the group to ask for a more thorough investigation by the Pentagon were rejected. I was also told that by early 2003, Paul Wolfowitz told a colleague at the Pentagon that the Pentagon was never going to investigate Dostum. So there were a whole series of efforts around the Bush administration where this issue came up, and in each case it was either ignored or rejected.
And so the significance of President Obama saying on CNN Sunday night that he is calling for an investigation, and also Hamid Karzai running for re-election now in the next month, reappointing Dostum chief military advisor.
Yes, it was that really makes this, I think, very relevant today. President Karzai has you know, in order to win re-election, he's a very good retail politician. General Dostum is an important figure in the ethnic Uzbek community of northern Afghanistan. He's basically the political godfather of the Uzbeks in Afghanistan. And in order to win that group, Karzai has tried to make peace with Dostum, who had been, you know, everyone knows that Dostum kind of switches sides at you know, over the course of his career many times. And people's patience in Afghanistan with him ended when he had this very bizarre and brutal incident where he tortured a political opponent. And there was a standoff between the Afghan police and Dostum at his compound in Kabul, and he finally kind of left the country under a cloud to Turkey, where he has, the Turks have kind of been his sponsors. But now Karzai is desperate to craft a winning political coalition, and he's cut a deal with Dostum to bring him back and reinstate him in exchange for Dostum's endorsement of Karzai in the presidential campaign.
We're talking to James Risen.
President Obama,
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to add one. I was just going to add that the problem for the Obama administration is that politically it's a very sensitive time for them because they're adding troops in Afghanistan at the same time there's a presidential election. They don't want to be seen as meddling in the election, but they also don't want to be sending in U.S. troops to support a government that includes war criminals. So it's a very difficult situation for them.
We're going to go to break. When we come back, we're going to play an excerpt of Jamie Duran's documentary, Afghan Convoy, and then come back to our conversation with James Risen and Susanna Serkin of Physicians for Human Rights. James Risen is author of the book State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. His piece this weekend is called U.S. Inaction Seen After Taliban POWs Died. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to an excerpt of the documentary Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death, by the award-winning Irish filmmaker Jamie Duran, who traveled to the site of the massacres and the mass graves in 2002 in Afghanistan. The film was researched by award-winning Afghan journalist Najibullah Qureshi, who almost was beaten to death to get video evidence of the complicity of U.S. Special Forces in the massacre. The witnesses who testified in the film are unidentified, have their faces obscured, but two of them are now dead. The clip begins with General Abdul Rahmatullah of the Northern Alliance explaining what happened to the Taliban members captured at Kunduz in November of 2001.
When the prisoners were captured in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz, they came here to Kalai Zaini. About 7,000 of them came here and we took control of them.
So what happened to the missing thousands? It's known that some hundreds were sold to the security services of their respective countries by the warlords, an Afghan tradition. Uzbeks to the feared SNB and Chechens to the KGB in Russia. Their fate can only be guessed at. The first few thousand to arrive at Kalyazhny were the lucky ones. After final checks to ensure they had no weapons, they were allowed to continue their journey by truck to Sheberhan prison, some 120 kilometers to the west. The jail, built to accommodate just 600 at most, was bursting at the seams.
Tell me about physically moving the prisoners from here to Sheberhan. That must have been very difficult.
General Dromatello of the Northern Alliance.
We used trucks to transport them. They were surrounded by soldiers. There weren't any buses, so we used lorries for their transportation.
At this point, our researcher interrupts.
What about the containers?
Containers? Oh, no. It's not good to mention that.
It's between you and me.
We put some of the prisoners in containers, but we had already made some holes for ventilation. We transported them by container to ensure we didn't lose any of them.
In a coordinated operation, truck drivers from all over the region had their vehicles commandeered by armed soldiers. Containers were loaded onto the back of the flatbeds and the drivers compelled to take their vehicles to Kalyazhny.
We were coming in from Mazar when they seized our trucks for free and took us to Kalyazhny, where there were already a lot of trucks. At about 2 a.m., they loaded our trucks with the prisoners. We were to the north of Kalyazhny, where we loaded the trucks.
Originally loaded onto trucks at Kunduz, many of these men were crammed 200 to 300 at a time into the backs of sealed containers. After around 20 minutes, the prisoners began crying out for air.
The weather was very hot. They put too many people inside the containers. Many died because there was no air.
Another eyewitness has asked how many containers were at Kalyazhny when he left.
There were about 25 containers. The condition of them was very bad because the prisoners couldn't breathe. So they shot into the containers and some of them were killed.
Another eyewitness.
They told us to stop the trucks and we came down. After that, they shot into the containers. Blood came pouring out of the containers. They were screaming
inside.
One Afghan
soldier admits that he personally murdered prisoners.
I hit the containers with bullets to make holes for ventilation, and some of them were killed.
You specifically shot holes into the containers. Who gave you those orders?
My commanders ordered me to hit the containers for ventilation, and because of that, some prisoners died.
But this was no humanitarian gesture. Rather than shooting into the roofs of the containers, the soldiers fired at random, killing those nearest the walls. A local taxi driver had called in at a petrol station on the road to Sheberhan.
I smelled something strange and asked the attendant where the smell was coming from. He said, "Look behind you." There were three trucks with containers fixed on them. Blood was running from the containers. My hair stood on end. It was horrific.
But for those prisoners crammed inside the containers, a quick death would have come as a blessing. Some of them remained for days in the desert before reaching Sheberhan. Accounts from survivors talk of licking the sweat off each other's bodies and even biting their fellow captives in a desperate effort to gain fluid in any form. The Pentagon has stated frequently that it knew nothing of the container convoy.
The Americans were in charge.
The interviewer asks, where were they, on the walls or near the gates of the fort?
They were standing at the front gates, where the prisoners were. When we got to the Shubergan prison, there were some Americans and some Afghan soldiers. They wanted to unload the trucks, and they were taking charge of the area.
How many American soldiers were there?
About 150 to 160. We didn't count the number.
What were the Americans doing in the prison?
They were there to make sure the prison was secure. There were so many Americans, and they were all armed and wearing their uniforms.
As the containers were opened, the full extent of the carnage became apparent. One soldier, who has since fled from Afghanistan, describes the scene in an interview with a Pakistani newspaper.
I shall never forget the sensation as long as I live. It was the most revolting and most powerful stench you could ever imagine. A mixture of feces, urine, blood, vomit, and rotting flesh. It was a smell to make you forget all other smells you ever experienced in your life.
For 10 days, the Red Cross tried to get access, but were refused. They were told that they couldn't enter because American soldiers were working inside. And this picture, taken at Shebahan on December 1st, 2001, during the period when the containers were arriving at the prison, confirms their presence. Witnesses speak of US soldiers searching the dead for identification before insisting that the Afghans remove the bodies from the prison. The Pentagon, however, will not comment.
It was particularly important to find any identification on these bodies because they were desperate for intelligence on Al-Qaeda. They had underestimated the strength of Al-Qaeda and its spread. They knew very little about it. So human sensibilities did go out of the window.
That was Robert
The healthy
Fox.
Captives were led into the prison and the dead packed into single containers. But many of the prisoners had not died. Some were so badly wounded, they were thrown back into the containers with the dead. Others were simply unconscious following the journey to Shebahan. Using a small tourist camera to avoid detection, we traveled to the desert of Dasht-e-Laili, just 10 minutes from the prison, with two drivers who agreed to show us where they were ordered to take the containers.
Some of the Taliban were injured, and others were so weak they were unconscious. We brought them to this place, which is called Dasht Layl, and they were shot there, there and over there.
Another eyewitness.
They took my truck and loaded a container to Shubergan and after that to Dasht Layli, where they were shot by the soldiers. I made four trips backwards and forwards with the prisoners.
The mounds of sand show clearly where many of the bodies lie. Human bones and a few pieces of clothing with Pakistani labels are all that remain of those buried near the top of the piles.
How many people were you carrying?
About 140 to 150 each time.
Did you bring them here?
Yes.
What was done with these people?
They were brought here and shot.
They were alive?
Some of them were alive. Some of these were injured and the rest were unconscious.
When you brought the prisoners here, were they with you?
Yes, they were.
Here at this spot?
Yes, here.
How many American soldiers were with you?
Lots of them, maybe 30 to 40. They came with us the first two times, but I didn't see them on the last two trips.
If American soldiers were involved in covering up their role at Shebarhan prison, it would border on war crimes. If they stood by as the summary execution of prisoners took place when they could have intervened, this would be positively criminal. But could the United States argue they were not in a responsible position?
They would not have taken orders from Afghans. They would have been in charge of security there, therefore it is an American command, therefore it is ultimately an American responsibility for whatever went on under the eyes of those American soldiers.
That was analyst Robert Fox.
It's quite clear that because you have film evidence of a mass grave, people confessing that the relevant authorities, be the American, Afghani, or international, must carry out an investigation. You have identified the site of a mass grave. You've identified bodies in those graves, and it's quite clear again that pathologists, forensic pathologists, exhuming the bodies, could identify the cause of death, and I think very importantly, could identify who these people are, because their families had a right to know. They have been disappeared involuntarily after being murdered.
That was international lawyer Andrew McGinty from the documentary Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we return to New York Times reporter James Risen and Susanna Serkin with Physicians for Human Rights. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests in Washington, D.C., James Risen, author of State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and Bush Administration, his latest article this weekend in the New York Times, U.S. in Action, Seen After Taliban POWs Died. And with us here in New York, Susanna Serkin, Deputy Director of Physicians for Human Rights, which has been calling attention to this massacre of hundreds, perhaps 2,000 suspected Taliban prisoners for a number of years now. At the top of the show, we played President Obama speaking to Anderson Cooper on CNN on Sunday in Africa, saying he will call for an investigation. And yet I'm looking at a piece 2 days before by AP on Friday saying Obama administration said they had no grounds to investigate the 2001 deaths of Taliban prisoners of war who human rights groups allege were killed by U.S.-backed forces. This is 2 days later, and he's completely doing a 180-degree turn. What's happening here?
Well, the initial response that we saw came from a Pentagon spokesperson and essentially tracks what we've been hearing from the U.S. government since Physicians for Human Rights discovered this prison and its conditions and then reported on the site and have repeatedly gone back to investigate and then calling for an international investigation. It's really welcome news to hear what the president said over the weekend. And I believe that really this is the first time the president has had a chance with his advisors to look seriously at the history of this and what needs to be done now. So I would say that what we've just heard from the president is really what the position is. And it's enormously welcome news for Physicians for Human Rights and for many others who've been working on this case for almost 8 years.
Susanna Serkin, when did you discover the mass grave?
We had a team with a physician and a human rights investigator that went to northern Afghanistan shortly after that surrender and the end of that initial and very serious conflict in the north. in 2001 to look at possible human rights violations. And our investigators discovered the horrific conditions at the Shebregan prison, reported on them. There were prisoners there who were literally dying before their eyes of starvation, terrible unsanitary conditions, cold, they had almost no clothing, et cetera. It was appalling. And while they were there, they heard reports that there had been these enormous numbers of bodies dumped into a mass grave, and they actually saw surface remains and reported that to Physicians for Human Rights headquarters. Immediately, we worked with the United Nations to get a forensic team back there, and within a month, Physicians for Human Rights with the UN High Commission for Human Rights had investigators on the ground, and within the next few months, we conducted an initial assessment and exposed 13 remains, autopsied three, and reported that the manner of death of those three was homicide, and the cause of death was consistent with suffocation, which matched the eyewitness testimonies that had been reported in the area and that you saw in the Jamie Durant's film.
The massacre site was intact until 2006?
As far as we know, Physicians for Human Rights has repeatedly called for protection of that site. There has never been any kind of protection, even though President Karzai and others promised that they would investigate the site and protect it. What we now know is, first of all, in 2008, one of our forensic scientists was able to go up to the area and noticed that there were very large holes in the area. This was reported by McClatchy in December 2008. What we now know from satellite imagery that appears in James Risen's New York Times piece and that has been provided by the American Association for the Advancement of Science is that in 2006, there are photos with not much area destroyed, but maybe one large hole. And then a few months later, we see pictures of images that are very consistent with large earth-moving equipment. Within a month of that picture, we see a very large hole right at the area where what appears to be a backhoe and a dump truck on the site. So it looks as though, actually, within a month of Physicians for Human Rights filing a Freedom of Information Act request to get what the U.S. government knew, all branches knew about the Dashti Leili massacre, the site has been dramatically damaged.
James Risen, can you talk about Del Spry, the FBI agent in Guantanamo, and what he learned?
Yeah, he was it was a longtime FBI agent who had been assigned on a temporary basis to go to Guantanamo in 2002 on a couple short temporary duty rotations. And while he was there, he was the senior FBI representative on the island. And he told me that during those times that, you know, he kept getting the agents who worked for him were interrogating and questioning detainees, and that he kept getting this pattern of reports from the detainees all talking about surviving this massacre. And he said that they would volunteer this information to the FBI agents, and that so he felt He really didn't think at first, he didn't believe the stories because he thought that he'd been told that Al-Qaeda tried to, fabricate stories of torture and abuse as part of their training. And so he didn't believe it, although when he began to hear all of these, he thought it would be important for the U.S. to at least investigate the allegations so that they could be debunked. Or else, if they didn't try to investigate it, then this story would hang out there, and the U.S. would pay the price in its reputation eventually. What he said was that he wrote up what the FBI call 302 reports, which are, you know, reports of an interview with someone, and that he got word back from FBI headquarters to drop the issue. And he was told that it was not his mission at Guantanamo to investigate, a massacre in Afghanistan. And instead, he should be focused on his role as looking for, you know, evidence to be used in trials of detainees and also for evidence, intelligence on possible future attacks against the U.S. What he told me was he understood it wasn't part of his mission, but thought that still it was something that should be looked into, and he was disappointed that the FBI didn't want to look into it. They told him that this was something for the Pentagon to look into, but as I said, it turns out that the Pentagon never really did look into it.
The significance of this, Susanna Serkin, and what Physicians for Human Rights is calling for now?
Well, we're now calling for, first of all, protection of the site and protection of any witnesses in Afghanistan and elsewhere who may have information. And we're calling for, and I'm beginning to get a response to this request, a thorough, transparent investigation by the U.S. government into who was on the ground, who was there at the site, who was there at the time that the prisoners were loaded up, and who was there and knew something and watched and perhaps maybe had any engagement in the suffocation and killing by a gunshot of these apparently more than 1,000 prisoners who had surrendered, and what the U.S. Did in response to legitimate requests that they investigate everything to do with this massacre.
Also, the witnesses killed. Can you talk briefly about this that Jamie Duran documented, talking to witnesses that were then killed, some of them tortured, for revealing this?
Yes, Physicians for Human Rights and the United Nations heard these reports and actually documented through other witnesses that several individuals were executed, disappeared, and tortured, people who knew about the incident or who were present. What is extremely disturbing is that we've now seen through the FOIA response that the U.S. government and apparently intelligence agency, it's a three-letter word that's redacted of an intelligence branch of the U.S. government in the FOIA, they knew and reported that eyewitnesses to this massacre had been killed and tortured. So there are clearly risks as we speak, and that's why Physicians for Human Rights is calling for an immediate protection and securing of the site, as well as protection of the witnesses by President Karzai and anyone else who is in a position to provide that protection.
James Risen, one more time, the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, turning to a U.S. general or demanding an investigation of this right at the time or soon after this happened and being turned down. You mentioned this earlier.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, what I don't was not given the identity of the military commander that they talked to. It was described as a military commander in the U.S.-led coalition, not necessarily an American. But it was, I think, fairly soon after the incident. And the way it was described to me was they got zero response from the military commander.
And we're,
if I could just add one other point.
We have 10 seconds.
Just one. Oh, I was just going to say something. I think it's very unclear what U.S. personnel knew at the time, and I think the investigation should focus rather on what happened afterwards in the Bush administration.
James Risen of the New York Times, Susanna Serkin of Physicians for Human Rights. Thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.